What remains to be said? To respond to that question, I'd like to call on our discussant to offer some reflections. Jeanette Klein is Associate Professor of History at the University of Akron and has devoted much of her research to Kurdish issues, as reflected in her monograph, The Margins of Empire, Kurdish Militias in the Ottoman Tribal Zone, published by Stanford University, 2011. She is presently engaged in a project discussing the construction of minorities in the late Ottoman period. Professor Klein.
Thank you for your kind introduction, and thank you, Cebu, for putting on this really wonderful conference, and Mary for all of her organizational help. I think it's really been probably one of my favorite conferences ever, and thank you for your inviting me. So these authors have presented us, as Professor Coey has said, with a very diverse range and very interesting papers. And they bring us into new and especially sophisticated, sometimes self-reflective, sometimes ethnographic analysis of who commemorates and how, who resists denialism, and how, along with presenting the trauma of witnessing or witnesshood, if we can say that. Commemoration and resistance are the two main themes that I draw from the papers in this panel, but as the authors illustrate in their wonderfully insightful presentations, neither of these topics is simple. For Soviet Armenians in the 1960s, commemoration was lived in a sense through peaceful revenge, a point Harutyun raises in his presentation after Silva Kaputikyan. This referred to taking revenge by continuing to live. But it wasn't just living, existing as living, breathing proof that Armenians were and are. It has been a commitment by Armenians, not just in the Soviet Union, but in the wider diaspora, of making, quote, the Armenian genocide recognizable by the world. But this commitment has its own history, its own geohistorical specificity, which he traces in his paper. And so does the commemoration of the genocide. As Harutyun also says, the notion of a collective memory implies a past that is not only commonly shared, but also jointly remembered, that is, co-memorated. But what if the group that is co-memorating is outside of the Armenian community? And I'm not just talking about commemorations by other state or non-state actors, but what if that community's history is so intricately bound up with the genocide, and perhaps even more importantly, the longer Armenian history, pre and post-genocide, that it cannot help but commemorate, as the papers by Anoush and Ruken show nicely. But sharing in that collective memory is complicated, as their papers highlight so wonderfully. I'm a relative newcomer to Armenian genocide studies per se. In my dissertation, which became my book, I didn't set out to study anti-Armenian violence. I was studying Kurdish society in the late Ottoman period, or so I thought. But I soon realized that the histories of both people are so intertwined that I'm not sure we can separate them, at least for the Ottoman period. They were, as the title of one article I read by Yele Verhej says, brothers, and I'll add sisters, of land and water. But they ended up being fate mates too, as Ruken demonstrates, which is a great word. Because Kurdish identity was denied for so long in Turkey, Turkey couldn't have a Kurdish question. Those PKK fighters who claimed they were Kurds were actually, it was said, as the state suggested in propaganda campaigns, more massive than I had known about before, they were actually Armenians. Proof? These allegedly uncircumcised bodies of fallen PKK fighters. So in a roundabout way, Kurds came to imagine Armenians, as Ruken suggests, as their fate mates in oppression and comrades in resistance, as one of their own. Previously non-political Kurds who had embraced the term Armenian as an insult processed their own identities in tandem with that of their fate mates of the late Ottoman period as those who could be killed without remorse. They became, as the narrative of Songül ends, Armenians themselves. But it must have always been difficult for Kurds to separate their present from the Armenian past, and not just in the sense that they transformed existing myths about moral agency into new forms which circulated as some kind of messianic implantment into retributive justice in the present for Kurds' roles in their past anti-Armenian violence, including the genocide itself. Must have been difficult because, as Anush illustrates, the very landscape of Kurdistan and Turkey, the former shared Kurdish and Armenian space, survives as a material testament, even if palimpsestic, if we can say that, to the shared present and past injustices. It is a landscape of ruins, as Anush suggests, or what Anne Stoller calls imperial debris. It is not just the state alleging in its propaganda that the PKK are really Armenians that bring Kurds in the present to relate to their shared past with Armenians, but rather the layer of ruins, burned down and destroyed Kurdish villages, layered upon remnants of the Armenian presence and present Armenian absence. Through Nazdar's story, Anush shows how the physical material remains of this Armenian presence, non-presence, has become a medium through which people in Van and elsewhere interact with and imagine the past. This landscape is haunted not only with the myths of retributive justice that Rukan explores, but also with the occult economies of treasure hunters and mythic history. Drawing on Rosalind Shaw's notion of palimpsest memories, we arrive, through both of their papers, at a multi-layered record of state violence and of a new form of commemoration, if we can say that. Rukan shows how these layered ruins may serve as sites of resistance against denialist history, or perhaps more cynically, as Hakob points out also, this ominous sense of absence can even be reconstructed into a disturbing form of tourism, with people who profit from this ominous sense of absence. So for loyal Kurds, for local Kurds, however, who are not there on tour, but actually live amid these ruins, they will not only recognize and experience this layered past, but imagine themselves anew as comrades in resistance. As such, Kurds since the 1980s have lived this resistance against denial of the Armenian genocide, but not unproblematically. I was in Diyarbakir in 2011, a couple of weeks after the consecration of Surgiragus, the largest Armenian church in the Middle East, which was reconstructed partly at the behest of the Kurdish municipal government, namely Osman Baydemir and Abdullah Demirbash. Both Baydemir and Demirbash were glowing over their achievement. They were genuinely proud and committed, and this was very evident in my conversations with them. But as Hachik Muradian wrote, as he reported this consecration in ArmenianWeekly.com, and I'm quoting him, renovated by the Surgiragos Armenian Foundation with the support of the local Kurdish-controlled municipality, the church, which had witnessed a century of destruction, neglect, and denial, now stood as defiant as ever to the forces suppressing freedom in Turkey. And as the faithful of different religions prayed in unison, the political message wasn't lost on anyone. The question that Rukan raises in her paper about transitional justice brings us to the point that we still cannot neatly separate time of conflict from time of post-conflict, for we seem to be caught in a time of both. So to close my remarks on bringing together the themes of commemoration and resistance, the two themes that emerged most prominently from the papers in this panel, I wonder, going back to my earlier note on how intertwined the histories of Kurds and Armenians are, if we ourselves and our subjects of study, if we do ourselves and our subjects of study a disservice, perhaps by trying to separate them. And this is also something that was raised very eloquently in yesterday's afternoon panels, the two-part panel. Can we have Armenian studies without Kurdish studies? Can we have Kurdish studies without Armenian studies? What might we gain from ditching the ethnic national approach to these histories? As groups who were never able to write a teleological nationalist history like Turkish nationalists were able to do, at least as it regards Eastern Anatolia, when I say Eastern Anatolia, can we somehow denationalize these histories while still recognizing the historical processes that contributed to the nationalization, minoritization, and violence against Kurds and Armenians as such? In our commemoration of the Armenian genocide, can we, as Kazancian asks through Ukren's paper, be prescient rather than nostalgic? Thank you.